American politician and lawyer Elliot Abrams, who has served in a number of U.S. administrations, has proposed to improve American foreign policy. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Abrams argued that the U.S. is at a critical crossroads when it comes to the defense of American freedom, security, and prosperity. Abrams says around the world, the U.S. faces significant national security threats, among them revisionist powers, the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and transnational terrorism, which are all made more dangerous by renewed great power competition with China. Abrams believed none of those challenges will disappear if America abandons the international role it has maintained since World War II as what he called the superpower leader of the free world. Abrams also says that is why he is joining with 75 other national security scholars and practitioners to launch the Vandenberg Coalition, a new network committed to advancing what has been described as a strong and proud American foreign policy. But what is this war party and what purpose does it serve?
We will eliminate all of these people with this dual loyalty, like Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is the son of Norman Podaritz, a son-in-law of Norman Podaritz and Mitch Decker, a classic neocon, a man who's willing to break the laws of the United States of America in the interest of Israel. He had to get a pardon in order to get his job, his security clearance. We need to have a clear dividing line here between the people who serve Israel, like Elliot Abrams, who serve Israel's interests, and the people who serve America's interests.
Many believe this sounds more like the project for the new American century. PNAC, which was active between the years of 1997 and 2006, was a new conservative think tank whose goal was to promote American global leadership. The group openly advocated for total global military domination, and many PNAC members held highest level positions in the George W. Bush administration.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Nothing has changed except the labels. These people were, for some reason, they didn't like Donald Trump. I don't understand this. He did everything that Israel wanted. But the problem here is that these people are always using front groups. They're always trying to disguise themselves as an American this or Republican that or conservative this. All of these labels are covers, they're disguises for the fact that these are Jews pursuing Jewish interests, this interest of the state of Israel and not the interest of the United States of America.
Elliot Abrams' proposal comes as the United States has already been actively engaged in multiple confrontations in the Middle East and East Asia. This now decades-long war on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and even Syria have led to nothing but deaths and destruction. The wars cost America trillions of dollars. However, numerous military manufacturers, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, have large contributions to U.S. wars by profiting the most from them. This is why growing arms investments mean a lot for international relations. Many believe this may be the reason behind the creation of the project suggested by Abrams. Meanwhile, Washington has been at a trade war with China for some years. It has also been initiating a potential altercation by keeping its presence in the South China Sea and other areas in the region. It seems that such comments by the likes of Abrams only serve the U.S. military manufacturers and the deep state which support forever wars as opposed to the policy of the new administration of President Joe Biden.
But if you're talking about America's interest, you're disguising once again the fact that this is Israel's interest, these are Jewish interests. And yeah, there is a military-industrial complex that profits from wars, that's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. Yet Washington wants to continue its wars and its costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I've paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and I contrast it, any further declaration that I have to make, I will, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected, is how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, which she did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating it, is conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently being grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown. Remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? Because what I certainly can tell him, and he asked about the October decisions, they were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleaze that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even pretty broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government of Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end interest, and that interest is in the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. You know, one of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
The U.S. has been after regime change in Venezuela for quite some time, especially during the presidency of the former president Hugo Chavez, was very vociferous in its anti-U.S. stance. The U.S. has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, freezing millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposing sanctions on the crisis of the economy of the Latin American nation. What has been termed as economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro. Last month, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slammed Washington's plan to transfer $150 million of the country's frozen funds from offshore accounts to the opposition led by Juan Guaido. Maduro lashed out at both the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition, calling them a pile of gangster bandits. While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions are directly targeted Venezuelan people who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. There's also the case of the failed U.S.-backed coup plot. Venezuelan security forces arrested dozens of people, including two Americans, after a beach invasion allegedly aimed to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. This was a plot which involved U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido. A Florida-based ex-Green Beret, Jordan Goodreau, told the Associated Press that he was working with the two American men in a mission launched early to liberate Venezuela.
I would point out that a lot of these failures are contemporary. They're things that are happening recently, and not to say that they weren't failures in the past, but we've seen how a lot of the regime change efforts in the past were far more successful than they have been recently. I think part of the problem for the United States, at least, is that the world is becoming a lot stronger and a lot more aware of some of the tactics that the United States is using.
Like other countries in South America, Venezuela is facing a harsh new pandemic wave, fueled by more infectious virus variants coming from neighboring Brazil. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of the Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
The first Palestinian national election in 15 years has been indefinitely delayed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made the announcement following a meeting with Ramallah-based political factions on Thursday. Abbas blamed Israel and the uncertainty about whether it would allow the vote to take place in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for the decision.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
The decision came 3 months after he issued a formal decree ordering a vote for the Palestinian legislature on May 22nd, and a Palestinian presidential election on July 31st, votes that could serve as an acid test for the legitimacy of the Palestinian political institutions, including his own presidency. Many observers believe the indefinite postponement is effectively a cancellation of the vote.
In my opinion, the best thing the Palestinian Authority can do is to dissolve itself. Anyone who tries to represent Palestinians today is compromised in some way, either because they are cooperating with the Israeli occupiers and oppressors, or because they can only operate if they're opposing them, as Hamas is. They can operate only within certain parameters because they're denied the ability to operate the way they would like to operate.
Hundreds of Palestinians staged a protest in Ramallah to denounce the decision. They chanted slogans calling for the formation of a legitimate government. Earlier in the day, hundreds of people had staged rallies in the Gaza Strip to condemn the Palestinian Authority chief's plans to call off the vote. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, denounced Abbas's decision, calling it, quote, a coup. In a statement, Hamas said the move goes against the path of partnership and national consensus, issues that cannot be pawned as collateral for the agenda of a faction. It also noted that the Fatah movement and the Palestinian president bear full responsibility for the decision and its consequence. In a separate statement, head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, condemned as unconvincing the decision, demanding that the elections of the Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority, and the National Council be held at agreed schedules. He added that the resistance movement is ready to cooperate with all Palestinian political factions.
A Hamas win might be satisfying to many. It might be satisfying in the sense that it confronts Israel and that it stands up for Palestinian rights. But in fact, a Hamas win means probably more oppression and less opportunity from the Israeli side, and it very possibly will be used as a pretext for Israel to be even more oppressive and to accelerate their genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because their ultimate objective is to have no Palestinians in Palestine.
Israeli authorities have made many efforts to either cancel or postpone the polls. Israeli forces have escalated an arrest campaign targeting key Hamas figures in the West Bank in recent months. Observers are drawing a parallel between the recent arrests and those made in the run-up to the 2006 elections, which resulted in a sweeping victory for Hamas.
قضیه فلسطین از یادان نخواهد رفت و شهر مقدس بیت المقدس پایتخت فلسطین باقی خواهد ماند و قبله اول مسلمان ها برای مسلمان ها باقی خواهد ماند.
The issue of occupied Palestine will never be forgotten. The holy city of Beit al-Muqaddas will remain forever the capital of Palestine. And the first Qibla of Muslims will always be there for Muslims. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration has recently played down one of the main drivers of Yemen's humanitarian crisis, a Saudi naval and air blockade that is preventing fuel and other critical supplies from entering the country, says Chris Gilardi, writer, in an article published under the heading, As Yemen's famine worsens, Biden does nothing. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. When President Joe Biden announced in February that he was ending U.S. support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales, Aisha Joman, president of the Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation, phoned her colleagues in Yemen. I was calling them to say there is a light at the end of the tunnel, said Joman, who is Yemeni-American. Not a single person believed it, she said. They knew better. So far, the skepticism of Joman's co-workers has been vindicated. Nearly 3 months have elapsed since Biden's statement, and he has yet to specify what constitutes an offensive operation. It remains unclear what, if anything, his administration has actually done to stop the Saudi Arabia-led military intervention. When asked by Congress recently for updates, Biden's Yemen envoy, Tim Lenderking, claimed ignorance. And this month, the White House announced that it was moving forward with a $23 billion arms sale to the United Arab Emirates, one of the main players in Yemen war. The Biden administration also recently played down one of the main drivers of Yemen's humanitarian crisis, a Saudi naval and air blockade that is preventing fuel and other critical supplies from entering the country. Rather than answer questions about the U.S. support for the Yemen intervention and blockade ongoing since 2015, a State Department spokesperson told Vox that the blockade is not a blockade, quibbling that some food and other supplies are getting into Yemen and that Yemeni authorities are also contributing to import problems. The denial followed comments from Leonard King, who last month attempted to shift the blame for fuel shortages onto Yemeni resistance forces, despite United Nations and press reports pointing to the Saudi blockade as the most immediate cause. The fact that the Saudis determine what gets into Yemen and what doesn't and when, that is a blockade, said Joman, adding that her organization hasn't been able to send medicine to Yemen in over a year. The Biden administration's equivocating and willingness to cover for Saudi Arabia's actions in Yemen and its opaqueness about its own continued involvement in the conflict track with a trend in U.S. policy in the region, one that far predates the Six-Year War. Even though the United States boasts tremendous influence over Yemen, Washington has for decades treated the country as a tool for pursuing tangential foreign policy goals, usually countering terrorism and maintaining warm relations with Saudi Arabia. As the Biden administration continues in the tradition of U.S. non-policy, the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which has been widely considered to be the world's most dire for roughly 5 years, grows more calamitous. 2.5 years ago, Save the Children estimated that around 85,000 children in Yemen under the age of 5 had died of malnutrition, and under current conditions, 400,000 more children could die by the end of this year, according to a February report from 4 UN agencies. The Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project estimates that fighting itself has so far taken around 100,000 lives. Biden has been given a very rare chance to correct the wrongs the United States has inflicted on the Yemeni people, said Joman. And instead of his taking the chance to correct that, we are seeing the same old story and same old behavior, she added. With the Biden administration's lack of clarity and action, Congress is considering stepping in. In late February, 41 Democratic representatives sent a letter to Biden asking him to elaborate on his commitments to end support for the Saudi-led offensive. But they never heard back, and as the Nation reported this month, members of Congress are currently assessing whether to introduce a war powers resolution to force Biden's hand. Joman of the Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation noted, "I fear right now that history is repeating itself," she said, "that Americans are going to sacrifice Yemen again to please the Saudis." Al-Adami, anti-war activist, recalled that during the 2020 campaign, one of Biden's senior national security advisors told her and a group of Yemeni Americans in Michigan that Biden would quickly end all support and arms sales for the war. So when it comes to Biden's promises, these are just, as far as I'm concerned, words, she said.
Around the World with Reporters.
It is estimated that prior to the pandemic, 27 million people worked in the EU's hospitality sector. Small to medium-sized firms are described as the backbone of the 27 nation bloc's finances. The Eurozone economy has contracted further and is now in a so-called double-dip recession. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts.
It's impossible to stop everything. You know, the corona is there, the economy is dead.
Like waitresses or waiters, and they lost their jobs, so they are in a bad condition now.
Me too. Like, I work, and my work is impact of the coronavirus.
It's very difficult to have hope, because we don't know how it's going on, and we don't know what the future it's made.
More and more workers lose their jobs, like restaurants.
Members of the European Parliament say the EU's aviation and tourism industries need emergency assistance.
Businesses in the hospitality sector are on their knees. They need not just financial support, but also longer-term measures to restart and recover. The tourism may never be the same.
Lawmakers say the EU's vaccination rollout is too slow. Just 10% of the population have been fully vaccinated. They are also highly critical over a lack of joined-up thinking when it comes to implementing COVID-19 restrictions. Governments were supposed to submit applications to the European Commission for recovery funding by last Friday. So far, just 14 of the 27 have done so. There is concern that the process lacks transparency.
We have encouraged all member states to make the submitted plans to the Commission public. But again, it's up to the member states to decide what they wish to publish.
An unprecedented social crisis might be on the horizon for the EU. It's possible the millions of jobs that have been lost so far only represent the tip of the iceberg. Several studies have concluded that up to one quarter of small to medium-sized businesses in the EU will go under once restrictions are lifted and government supports are taken away. These are firms that employ 250 people or less. Clearly, then, we're talking about huge numbers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkey prioritizes Libya's integrity, sovereignty and independence. This is what Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu told his counterpart Najla Almankosh in a statement made after his visit, along with Defense Minister Hulusi Akar, Intelligence Chief Hakan Fidan and the Chief of Staff Yashar Güler to Tripoli. During the meeting, Almankosh urged Turkey to help implement a UN Security Council resolution demanding the retrieval of foreign fighters from Libya. Cavusoglu responded to the remarks by saying that Turkish troops and mercenaries sent by Ankara were deployed in Libya as part of an agreement made with the previous administration and were only present for the purpose of training.
In the face of the attacks on Tripoli over the past years, the legitimate government of Libya invited some countries, including us. Only Turkey replied in the affirmative to this call. Turkey's support for Libya prevented a civil war and human tragedy.
This visit is seen by many as very important for Turkey to maintain good ties with the new Libyan government and make sure agreements are not broken due to political changes in Tripoli. However, it seems that the new government does not welcome foreign troops anymore.
Turkey signed an agreement with the central government in Tripoli, which is recognized by the UN. Based on that agreement, Turkey sent troops and mercenaries to Libya. Unless that agreement is broken by any or both sides, Turkish troops will continue to be present there. Turkish forces are not alone there. There are also Syrian fighters, Chadian army, as well as Russian. Their presence must also be questioned.
Turkey also signed an agreement with the previous Libyan government on maritime boundaries in the Mediterranean, which created tensions between Turkey and Greece. Ankara sees a great importance in maintaining good relationship with the Tripoli amid mounting tensions in eastern Mediterranean. Libya is still considered Turkey's strategic partner. For Turkey, the visit meant to make sure things are still going well after the new Libyan interim government was sworn in. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and their remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign minister's spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Yemeni army said it had launched an operation using 4 drones of Qassaf K2 type and 2 ballistic missiles of Badr type against Saudi Arabia targeting King Khalid Air Base in Asir and other military targets in Najran Airport.
Our operation targeted Saudi airports because they are being used for warplanes to take off and launch airstrikes on the Yemeni people. They are also used to reinforce the Saudi-backed forces in Ma'rib and the rest of the battlefronts. We carry out the operation based on accurate information that reached us from the Saudi depths.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army said this attack came in response to the continued escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its tighter restrictions on fuel imports. He vowed larger attacks if the war is not yet stopped.
The continuation of the Yemenis' attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia confirms that the Yemeni army has developed its military capabilities to inflict further damage to Saudi sites. The Yemeni army aims to protect Yemen's airspace against Saudi airstrikes in conjunction with the continued advancement toward the city of Ma'rib.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015. The Saudi war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children and brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Experts say the Yemeni army's retaliatory attacks sent this clear message to Saudi Arabia and its allies that the more attacks against Yemeni civilians and tighter blockade, the more painful attacks against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden called North Korea a threat in his first address to Congress, as his administration announced it had completed a long-awaited review of American policy toward Pyongyang. Biden's remarks were soon followed up by his Director of National Intelligence.
For its part, North Korea may take aggressive and potentially destabilizing actions to reshape its security environment and will seek to drive wedges between the United States and its allies. These efforts could include the resumption of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing in the future.
North Korea reacted harshly to the comments, with a leading official saying the U.S. would face a very grave situation if it did not end its hostile policy. In South Korea, Washington's rhetoric was met with disappointment.
The Biden administration has said it will pursue resolute deterrence while the North Korean nuclear issue is a threat to the world peace. So for Pyongyang, Washington's hostile policy seems only a pretext to strengthen itself.
North Korea has been subject to U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which Pyongyang would like to be suspended. There are also other moves the U.S. could make to get talks going.
Since there is a large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in August that North Korea sees as a hostile, an announcement suspending these drills would help create an atmosphere of dialogue.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with President Biden at the Oval Office later this month, where he's likely to press for engagement between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Sunday that Washington's policies not aimed at hostility, but solutions. The question is whether those solutions involve U.S. incentives that will bring Pyongyang to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
U.S.-led NATO forces are spending their last months in Afghanistan, and this is good news for most American soldiers. They will finally witness the end of their mission in a country historically known as the Graveyard of Empires. This is why the U.S. war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of 90,000 U.S.-led NATO troops and Afghan armed forces. However, military top brass in Kabul insists that there is zero chance of victory for the Taliban through militarism, despite the start of foreign troops withdrawal from Afghanistan on Saturday. This is because the Afghan government is now strong enough to counter terrorist groups on its own and also enjoys high popularity among locals.
The withdrawal of foreign forces has practically started. They will hand over their military bases and some of their military hardware to Afghan forces by the end of this week. We are strong enough and we can safeguard the nation on our own.
In the meantime, the Taliban have not welcomed the troop pullout by Washington, saying the U.S. had agreed to withdraw all foreign military forces from Afghanistan by the May 1st. This has paved the way for the Taliban to legitimize their acts of violence beyond May the 1st. Under such circumstances, civilians will once again turn into the main victims of violence in the war-weary country.
Foreign troops must leave our country, and the Taliban are also expected to respect people's demand, that is the silence of guns. There must be no war among ourselves after the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban need to realize this reality.
The Taliban are seeking excuses to keep saying no to peace. The postponement of the U.S. military withdrawal has now turned into a good pretext for them to wage more war and kill more defenseless civilians.
The Taliban have vowed to take any possible action because of what they call the violation of the Doha Agreement by Washington, that is the delay in the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. However, what remains to be a bitter truth is that not many players seem to be ready to truly help Afghans see a day when there is no war and insecurity in their wounded homeland. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Bye.
Pakistan's federal parliament in Islamabad. The lower house of the parliament is preparing to resume a debate on whether or not to expel French ambassador over a repeated incident of blasphemy in France against Islam's last prophet Muhammad. However, days before the resumption of parliamentary debate here, the European Union Parliament has come up with what appears to be counter-resolution to pressurize Islamabad to prevent the expulsion of French envoy from Pakistan. The European Parliament has decided to review with Pakistan our trade agreement known as Generalized System of Preferential Plus or GPS Plus over what it calls a rising anti-French sentiments and mistreatment of minorities under blasphemy laws in Pakistan. Under this trade deal, Islamabad gets an estimated annual additional $1.5 billion trade benefits, which are far less than the economic losses Pakistan suffers almost every year because of mass unrest linked with Islamophobia in France. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in France has led to mass unrest across Pakistan.
The European Union is putting pressure on Pakistan, and they want them to weigh and to see whether this decision of expelling the French ambassador from Pakistan, will the government of Pakistan, will the people of Pakistan pay the price? Are they ready?
European Union's concerns go much beyond possibly expelling French ambassador.
Prime Minister Khan has crossed the Rubicon. EU policy towards countries that enable Islamic extremism must be resolute. Withdraw Pakistan's GSP Plus status now.
In an official reaction, Islamabad expressed disappointment with the European Union, pointing out that it reflects a lack of understanding in the context of blasphemy and associated religious sensitivities in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world.
None of the convict of the blasphemy law was ever executed in Pakistan after successful governments and superior judiciary allegedly buckled under pressure to set convicts free and led them to migrate and settle in Europe. This has led to lynching of 75 under trial prisoners and suspects amid reports of misuse of blasphemy law in isolated cases since 1987 onwards. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Every year on the 1st of May, protesters fill the streets of cities around the world, marching on what's known as May Day or International Labour Day. Demonstrators usually consist of various groups supporting a wide variety of causes. Yet this year in the UK, activists joined more than 40 protests throughout the country centred around one thing: opposition to the controversial police crime sentencing and courts bill, with the main focus of dissent coming from London.
Most notable to me were the fact that the police, under the powers of this legislation, and this is new, will be able to say that this demonstration, for example, through the noise that it's causing, is causing a nuisance. And if that nuisance is serious, they will be able to arrest people, fine them up to £10,000, and imprison them.
What will be next? That bill comes through, that's just going to be one of a whole range of new policies and things that would just silence any form of criticism.
The new legislation pending in Parliament could allow police to impose conditions on protests, including start and finish times and the imposition of noise limits. This bill would also allow the police to prematurely end a protest if it caused serious annoyance to the surrounding community, organisation and businesses, which demonstrators argue is the whole point of protests.
This bill makes it impossible to have any kind of strike, any kind of picket that has any effect.
Thousands upon thousands have turned up here to defend the right to protest, something Brits up and down the country feel is under threat.
More than 600 civil society and protest groups have called for the government to drop the legislation, and the mobilisation of protesters on the streets has already forced a planned passage through Parliament to be delayed. Yet only time will tell whether the huge protests up and down the country has successfully defeated the anti-protest bill. Ahmed Gabello, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As recently as 2019, the FBI used surveillance tools intended for tracking foreign terrorists and spies in unrelated domestic crime investigations involving Americans without even seeking secret warrants from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA Court. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Scott Shackford Ryder. This article is published under the heading Report says FBI misused foreign surveillance powers to investigate domestic crimes. Stay tuned, please, for the details. As recently as 2019, the FBI used surveillance tools intended for tracking foreign terrorists and spies in unrelated domestic crime investigations involving Americans without even seeking secret warrants from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA Court. The information comes from a recent certification report from the FISA Court itself, written in November, but declassified and released by the Office of Director of National Intelligence recently. The report documents 40 instances in which the FBI secretly accessed data collected not about foreigners but about American citizens for investigations of healthcare fraud, transnational organized crime, violent gangs, domestic terrorism involving racially motivated violent extremists, as well as investigations connected to public corruption and bribery. Though it is the FBI's job to investigate such crimes, in these instances, they did so using data collected under the Section 702 authorities of FISA, which does not permit targeting Americans for these types of investigations. Section 702 specifically focuses on unwarranted searches of foreign targets because they don't have the protections of the Fourth Amendment and therefore their communications can be collected and reviewed. Even with that clearance, the FISA court exists to make certain that the FBI and National Security Agency do not abuse their access against Americans, which is exactly what happened here. When Congress renewed Section 702's authorities in 2018, they actually codified permission to use this part of the law for domestic surveillance for certain types of crimes, like human trafficking. Yet the FBI still misapplied it. Nevertheless, despite these violations of procedure and of Americans' privacy, the FISA court went ahead and renewed federal certification for this section 702 surveillance. The explanation as to why actually goes back to a completely different FBI violation. When the agency screwed up its search warrants to the FISA court when surveilling Carter Page, former Trump campaign aide, as part of the investigation into whether Donald Trump or people in his orbit had been compromised by agents, they got permission to wiretap Page's communications. But the FBI cut corners on the warrant applications and omitted information that likely would have raised questions as to whether the surveillance was justified. and a subsequent audit from the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Justice found that the FBI routinely made errors in its warrant request to the FISA court when asking to surveil Americans. After those problems were publicly revealed in 2019, the FISA court ordered the FBI to submit a formal plan for fix them. Director Chris Wray responded with a 40-point training plan to correct FBI surveillance procedures so that they are compliant with privacy protections for Americans. This latest FISA court report notes that these newly discovered violations took place before Ray's training program was implemented. So, as FISA court judge James Boasberg explains in the report, they are going to assume until they discover otherwise that Ray's reforms fixed these problems. "I'm not kidding," Boasberg writes. "The court finds that the proposed procedures, as reasonably expected to be implemented, comply with applicable statutory and Fourth Amendment requirements." That feels like a massive shrug, given the number of mistakes the FBI has been making in both submitting proper FISA warrants and in snooping through Americans' data without warrants. But the recertification in this report comes with the strings attached. Boasberg is ordering quarterly reports detailing each instance in which FBI personnel accessed Section 702, acquired information about an American that wasn't for the purpose of foreign intelligence gathering, what information is used for, precisely how it happened, and whether it was consistent with their 702 authorities. The increased transparency about how this FISA court surveillance works due to both reforms that followed Edward Snowden's disclosures as well as attention brought by the investigation of Trump's campaign has been a boon to the public in understanding that this system is far from perfect. As we can see, even with this more visible oversight, the FBI keeps making mistakes that violate Americans' Fourth Amendment protections against warrantless searches. It's something to remember whenever anybody attempts to argue that the FBI needs more authority or more laws to combat domestic terrorism. It is not properly respecting the limits on the power it already has.
The Brereton Report, released in late 2020, documents alleged war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. An inquiry into war crimes committed there by British Special Forces as well was also concluded just a few months earlier, with many similarities. This is a topic that is often overlooked and underreported, especially given the severity of the crimes. Let's take a closer look at what we